Today is Monday, May 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Is South Korea looking at a second wave of COVID-19 cases?
Just as the country began easing some social distancing restrictions last week.
Plus, protests return to Hong Kong.
Hundreds of riot police were deployed to disperse protesters across the city on Sunday, as protesters chanted for freedom and held up banners calling for revolution.
And we say goodbye to an American rock and roll icon. Those stories and more next. South Korean officials are racing to contain a new coronavirus outbreak. Reuters' Libby Hogan starts us off.
A new outbreak of coronavirus cases in South Korea has sent officials scrambling to stop its spread in the densely populated capital city of Seoul. Officials reported over 30 new infections across the country as of midnight on Sunday, the highest daily numbers in more than a month. The country has been lauded for its early action in slowing the pandemic, but on Sunday, President Moon Jae-in warned of a second wave.
It's not over until it's over, while keeping enhanced alertness till the end. We must never lower our guard regarding epidemic prevention.
Most of the recent infection cluster was linked back to a slew of clubs and bars in the popular nightlife district of Itaewon, many of which cater to members of the LGBTQ community. That has raised complications for officials desperately trying to track down new infections in a nation where open homosexuality is often taboo and LGBTQ people still face significant discrimination, including job loss and hate speech. Authorities had tested 4,000 people, but were still trying to track down around 3,000 more. Seoul Mayor Park Won-soon has pleaded with clubgoers to be tested, warning that anyone avoiding testing could be fined.
The next 2 or 3 days will be a critical moment which decides if Seoul will be infiltrated or not. If Seoul was infiltrated, the Republic of Korea will be infiltrated.
The outbreak has prompted Seoul to impose an immediate temporary shutdown of all nightly entertainment facilities, just as the country began easing some social distancing restrictions last week.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. South Korea's education ministry announced that it will postpone the reopening of secondary schools, which was scheduled to begin Wednesday, by 1 week in light of the new outbreak. South Korea's education minister, Park Byung-bom, said the reason to delay the school openings was to ensure the safety of students and because the government did not have the capacity to test all 600,000 of them. Also in Asia, China's government reports that new cases of COVID-19 have been found in Wuhan, the city in the center of the country where the outbreak was first identified. A cluster of cases is now being traced just a few days after the city began to ease its coronavirus lockdown. In the United States, the Trump administration is moving ahead with its focus on states easing restrictions and reopening parts of the U.S. economy, while also dealing with coronavirus infections among White House staff. At least 2 White House aides have tested positive for COVID-19. A valet for President Donald Trump and the press secretary for Vice President Mike Pence. A spokesman for Mike Pence said the vice president has tested negative and will return to the White House on Monday. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the White House chief expert in the fight against the coronavirus, is self-isolating, although he has also tested negative. 2 other top members of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, Food and Drug Administration Chief Stephen Hahn and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Robert Redfield, are self-quarantining for 2 weeks after attending a meeting where one of the infected staff members was present. A total number of confirmed COVID-19 cases worldwide has topped 4.1 million. This past week, a main coronavirus vaccine trial is now underway, a joint venture between an American and a German company. Some participants are U.S. medical students. This trial joins others around the world as pharmaceutical companies compete to discover a breakthrough for COVID-19. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti takes us through what's being done and how.
Michael Sikorsky is about to make history.
Look in that corner.
He is the 7th medical student to get an injection of a trial vaccine for COVID-19.
1, 2, 3.
I feel
a sense of responsibility and obligation as a young, healthy adult who can participate in one of these early trials to do so.
Sikorsky and 360 others are in the first phase of vaccine trials run by Pfizer and its German partner, BioNTech.
And you can do all of this from the outside.
The company is simultaneously testing four vaccines using a newer method called mRNA. The vaccine introduces part of the virus's genetic code through RNA. The body treats it like a foreign protein, which generates an immune response. Pfizer's Mikhail Dolstein.
And now the body is ready. It has memory. And once the real virus knocks on the door to infect us, we respond fast and intercept it.
The challenge for Pfizer is to prolong the life of the antibodies in the cells. Many drug companies are racing to become the first to conquer the virus. U.S. firm Moderna, along with the National Institutes of Health, is using mRNA in trials that began last month. Inovio has already started its efforts using a DNA method. BioNTech Pfizer began its trials May 5th, while China's CanSino Biologics is ahead of the others, already on to its phase 2 trials. The University of Oxford in England started trials last month, and Wuhan and Beijing researchers are using a traditional trial method, injecting inactive viruses. The nation's leading infectious disease expert predicts the world will have an effective vaccine by October.
And then the challenge will be to scale it up enough to be able to distribute it meaningfully.
Meanwhile, participants like Sikorsky are monitored for vaccine safety.
So every night at 9 o'clock, I get a little buzz on my cell phone that reminds me about your safety diary. So I take out the thermometer that they gave me and I check my temperature. And then I fill out a series of questions, which include, do you have any aches or pains? Do you have fevers? Is there swelling?
If all goes well, a coronavirus vaccine is expected to be in circulation by the end of the year. An unprecedented rapid development for a vaccine. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
The COVID-19 pandemic has created fear and anxiety, and in many cases, grief and sorrow everywhere in the world. While most people try to stay safe through isolation or physical distancing, workers rush in to help the sick and their families, the very people who may endanger them. In a new series, International Edition will bring you interviews with American healthcare workers who are doing his or her best to cope and to serve others. For the series' first installment, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Anthony Hendricks, an ambulance paramedic in Oakland, California, where COVID-19 infections of African Americans and Hispanics have been especially high. Hendricks told Adam his shift always begins with a dispatcher's urgent call.
Yeah, I get a call on the radio and also on our computer. We get on scene and either we'll gown up or mask up with our PPE or personal protective equipment, or sometimes we don't have time because someone is dying at that point. So we're walking up some flight of stairs with the EKG monitor to look at their heart rate, our airway bag, our drug bag to help save this patient.
So what happens when you get there?
It's usually we'll meet a family member there that says, hey, my mom, my grandma, my daughter is sick. Then that's the hard part, is we have to figure out how we're going to be able to carry all of our equipment down with the patient to get them to our gurney. There's times where we have to make 2 or 3 trips coming back in and out of the house. And after we get the patient out, we'll put them in the ambulance. And then we treat as best we can while we're standing, trying to hold on while my partner drives. It's nerve-wracking because there's ventilation in the back, but we're in an ambulance with a patient that's possibly COVID, and it's very hard because my job is to save life, and now we have to worry about our own safety.
Do you guys have the supplies and equipment you need to protect yourselves?
At first, we had a lot of equipment, but we are running out now. We are reusing equipment, unfortunately.
Sounds like a brave new world.
I'm not sure if it's going to be good or bad, but medicine is definitely going to change now. We're able to do more things than we have been in the past because we're a state of emergency, and we're able to provide medications now that we weren't able to, like insulin, things like that. And now we're actually able to divide medicine up and give it to patients, which is good. We have the skills and the knowledge to provide better care now. But as a paramedic, I'm still worried, you know, because before all this happened, you would get a homeless gentleman coughing. You're like, oh, cover your mouth. But I think now that we're going to get that individual and they start coughing and we're going to be very paranoid. We're going to turn on all the vents. We're going to start doing medical treatments outside of the ambulance. And we used to do it normally en route to the hospital. And in the past, we would arrive at the hospital and walk in, talk to a nurse or a doctor and get a room. Now we're waiting in the ambulance for the patient, and then they have to do a whole bunch of screening to get the patient to the room. So when it used to be maybe 2-3 minutes from arriving to the hospital to get them to a bed, it's now 10, 15, 20 minutes. But some of those sick, critical patients, they need to get in.
Are patients more resistant to being hospitalized when you come get them?
Yeah, it just happened the other night. It was a retired nurse that just retired a couple years ago, but she started having dementia and she was having some breathing problems and some chest pain, cardiac chest pain. And she didn't want to go to the hospital because of the COVID. She was very scared, but I was more scared that she might die from a heart attack or some kind of arrhythmia. It came down to a emotional argument where I said, if you don't go, you're going to die here. She said, I don't care, because she was more worried about not being able to come back to her residence because she would have to be quarantined.
I understand that the protocol in some places is not to try to revive patients if they've been dead for a certain amount of time, where before you might have.
It's not in California, but I know there has been protocols. It's in other areas where I'm going to try to make efforts to resuscitate. That's difficult because I want to do the best I can for the patient I'm dealing with right there, but also I want to continue my job to provide that care for future patients. It's mentally exhausting.
It must be tempting just to go numb sometimes.
There has been moments when I've been numb, but honestly, this is why I feel that I'm on this earth. Besides being a husband and a father, I love medicine. I love my job. It's amazing just to be there and to give my knowledge and my hope.
How do you maintain your own sense of hope through all this? Do you get therapy, for example?
Therapy, definitely. I'm also part of our peer support team. We use Facebook and other social medias to reach out to other coworkers and other friends. But the big thing is talking about what you're feeling, what you're going through, and to know that it's okay to have those feelings.
Anthony Hendricks is an ambulance paramedic in Oakland, California. He was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York via Zoom. We will have more on Wednesday as Adam continues his series with interviews with healthcare workers fighting on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States. And coming up later,
police arrested over 250 people following a day of anti-government protests.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A recent study suggests men have more serious issues with COVID-19 and are almost twice as likely to die from the disease than women. Another new study published in the European Heart Journal may help explain why. Citing evidence from data gathered from about 2,000 heart failure patients, the researchers say men have a higher concentration of angiotensin-converting enzyme 2, also called ACE2, in their blood than women. According to the study researchers, ACE2 allows the SARS coronavirus 2 to infect the body's healthy cells. The researchers say that while ACE2 can be found in various parts of the body, there are very high levels of the enzyme in the male reproductive gland, which may explain in part why men are more at risk to COVID-19. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The son of a Pakistani migrant plans to sue the Greek state over a shooting along the Greek-Turkish border that killed his father in March. The alleged shooting happened as Greek forces were resisting attempts by Turkey to push more than 150,000 asylum seekers into Greece after President Recep Tayyip Erdogan lifted border controls, saying that he would no longer stop migrants and refugees from passing into Europe. The controls have since then been reinstated to contain the spread of the coronavirus. But as Anthony Karasava reports, Greece and Turkey continue to blame one another over the fatal shooting.
The alleged shooting happened as Greek forces were resisting attempts by Turkey to push more than 150,000 asylum seekers to Greece after President Erdogan lifted border controls, saying he would no longer stop migrants and refugees from passing into Europe. The controls have since then been reinstated to contain the spread of the coronavirus. But Greece and Turkey continue to blame each other for the fatal shooting. Anthi Karasava reports from Athens. It is not clear whether Greek authorities intended to kill Muhammad Gulzar, but independent investigators studying details of the fatal border incident on March 4 say all evidence points to Greek forces being responsible for the death of the 42-year-old Pakistani migrant. Greece's government spokesman has been quick to deny the allegation, maintaining the administration's position from the start that any suggestion that Greece is responsible is fake news and part of a gross and deliberate misinformation campaign originated from the government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The damning evidence, including hundreds of videos and testimonies, was compiled by investigative teams from independent fact-checking and open sources researchers from three organizations, Bellingcat, Forensic Architecture, and Lighthouse Reports. Next to the testimonies, researchers say they also got a hold of Gulzar's death certificate, which shows he was killed with a 5.5-millimeter bullet, live ammunition commonly used in the rifles arming Greek border guards. While videos compiled by researchers show Greek soldiers within close distance of the shooting, none have captured them firing at any migrant. At least six other migrants were injured in the day's shooting. Gulzar, though, was shot dead in the chest after having approached the border fence to talk to some of the guards, hoping to convince them to allow him and his newlywed wife to pass into Greece. Gulzar had lived in Greece for more than 12 years, working various jobs, including his last gig as a chimney sweep. He was known to the authorities and had a long-standing application to receive a residency permit. The migrant had been married to a young lady in Pakistan, where he had gone to pick her up and to visit his ailing family. His son from his first wife told the British broadcaster Sky News.
His mother is very sick, and his father is very sick, and my mom, she is very sick.
Whether the government in Athens will open a detailed investigation into the border killing remains unclear. But Gulzar's son, who lives in Greece and wants to keep his identity secret, has told Sky News that he is working with lawyers to press manslaughter charges against the Greek state.
I am very angry because my father has died and I am so crying.
With relations between Athens and Ankara at a record low, experts fear this case could escalate tension, as Turkey has warned that it will reopen its borders to allow migrants to freely pass into Greece once it manages to contain the COVID-19 pandemic. Antika Rasava, VOA News, Athens.
One Iranian warship accidentally struck another with a missile during an exercise, killing 19 sailors and wounding 15 others. Iran's Navy said the incident took place during training in the Gulf of Oman, a sensitive waterway that connects the Strait of Hormuz, through which about a fifth of the world's oil passes. Iran regularly conducts exercises in this area. The frigate Jamaran fired at a training target released by the support ship, the Konarak. However, the support ship stayed too close to the target and was hit, according to state media. U.S. President Donald Trump says that he did not know the Justice Department was planning to drop its case against his former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. The unusual action underscored the extent to which Trump and Attorney General William Barr have been in sync in their views on the federal Trump-Russia investigation. Barr himself has openly challenged the decisions of his predecessors and his own prosecutors. At least six members of the Afghan National Army were killed and five others wounded in a Taliban attack in Laghman province in eastern Afghanistan Sunday night, according to the Afghan Ministry of Defense. However, an anonymous government source and area residents say at least 10 soldiers were killed. A defense ministry statement said Afghan forces repulsed the attack in the Alishing district and caused the Taliban heavy casualties, but the government source said at least 10 Afghan army vehicles were also destroyed in the attack. Hong Kong authorities arrested more than 200 people during pro-democracy protests after a sing-along demonstration at a shopping mall spilled out into the streets of the Chinese-ruled city. Earlier today, I spoke with Hong Kong-based journalist Ria Mogul via Skype for the details.
Hundreds of protesters gathered in malls to chant slogans and sing songs, which is actually quite a common form of protesting in Hong Kong. The protesters had initially planned to march down a major road in Hong Kong to demand the resignation of our chief executive, Carrie Lam. But there was no permit, obviously, because of social distancing rules. And so they gathered in malls instead. And then the police entered the malls and took people away because they were gathered in groups of more than eight. And as the current social distancing rules stand, you're only allowed to be gathered within a group of eight people. But many people believe, actually, that the government is using social distancing to suppress the protest movement. And in scenes quite reminiscent to last year's anti-government movement, protesters attempted to block the roads by using bins and traffic cones, and pepper spray was fired in retaliation. Several pro-democracy lawmakers were also present, and one lawmaker was arrested as well. Now, the police have also faced accusations of brutality yet again and have particularly come under fire for suppressing journalists. They forced them to kneel and stop filming what was happening around them. Also under fire, the police are under fire for taking away a young 13-year-old boy who was part of a youth reporting group, and he was filming what was happening around him, and they took him away. So people were very angry about that, very angry about the multiple rounds of pepper spray fired on the streets as well as inside the malls, and of course, not allowing the press to film what was happening around them.
You mentioned the police taking away a young boy. This is not the first time that has happened. It's also not been the first time that there have been allegations that the police have restricted what journalists can film or report in these things. Has there been any response from organizations, say like the Hong Kong Journalists Association, about what took place?
Yeah, the union and also the FCC, the Foreign Correspondents Club in Hong Kong, have publicly condemned the police for stopping journalists from allowing to do their job. And, you know, they think it's particularly bad that they were made to sit down, forcibly kneel on the road and stop filming what was happening around them. Also, as you said, yes, it's not the first time that the police have taken away a young boy. In fact, you know, majority of the anti-government protesters are young people. You know, they're in university or they're in high school. So it's very common. And the police have responded by saying that they used the appropriate level of force. In fact, next month, we'll be coming up to the one-year mark of that historic 2 million strong march in Hong Kong. So I imagine during these big anniversaries, there is going to be some sort of protest or demonstration.
Ria Mogul is a journalist based in Hong Kong. Comedy star of stage, film, and television, Jerry Stiller has died at the age of 92. Stiller became famous in the 1960s as he teamed with his wife, Ann Mira, in films, stage productions, commercials, and TV programs, including The Ed Sullivan Show. He found renewed fame in the 1990s playing the cranky, loud Frank Costanza on the television program Seinfeld. Also this week, Little Richard, one of the chief architects of rock and roll, whose piercing wail, pounding piano, and towering pompadour irrevocably altered popular music and introduced black R&B to white America. He died on Saturday after battling bone cancer at the age of 87. Born Richard Pennyman, Little Richard was one of rock and roll's founding fathers who helped shatter the color line on the music charts, joining Chuck Berry, Fats Domino, and others in bringing what was once called race music into the mainstream. Richard's hyperkinetic piano playing, coupled with his howling vocals and hairdo, made him an implausible sensation. A gay black man celebrated across America during the button-down Eisenhower era. He sold more than 30 million records worldwide, and his influence on other musicians was equally staggering, from the Beatles and Otis Redding to Clearance Clearwater Revival, as well as David Bowie. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. I'm Steve Miller in Washington, and until next time, make it a magnificent Monday.